the big comeback I mentioned, like, you know, he kind of had like a rough patch there when he was like in 13th Gate and The Astronaut's Wife and, you know, some of those movies in the early 2000s, late 90s that didn't do so well.
Yeah, The Ninth Gate.
The 19th Gate, yeah.
No, The Ninth.
I'm going to, like, reach through this podcast and strangle you.
Go for it. It's The Ninth. I'm just telling you, it's The Ninth Gate.
You're right. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are my friend and co-host, Richard Wally.
And from California, you are not my friend. No, I don't know why. You are Cassidy Robinson. You're from that LA land.
Yes.
La La Land.
La La Land. I wonder if anyone's made that joke before. I'm sure they did.
I think they have. I'm pretty sure I stole it.
A lot of weird astrological things happened over the weekend.
Like astrological, like the rising of Saturn, and it's going to influence your year badly?
No. Like, I mean, I guess maybe. We could talk about those kind of theories, but there's the super blood moon, which happened yesterday.
Oh.
And there was the whole water on Mars thing, which you think is some sort of conspiracy.
Oh, I don't think it's conspiracy. I just saw an article go up just a little bit ago. I didn't really read it. I'm just like, okay.
What was the article?
It just said that the droid or whatever that was sending things back was glitching. But I don't know if that's true or just somebody.
Was this
Or this was Stanley Kubrick somehow fessing up to.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Faking
it. That's what I was going to say. Is this from don'tbelieveeverythingyouread.com?
Yeah, I don't know. It could be.
Again, including us.
I didn't look at the article, so I can't really state to its its validity or not, but no, it's
science is a show from the newworldorder.com.
Well, it is. I mean, you can pay for results, you know.
Right. no, I don't know what all of this is supposed to mean other than the apocalypse, I assume.
Well, it just means that Elon Musk will get his way sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm. The clouds will open up and we'll see large tentacles reaching down from the heavens.
Oh, okay. So you're going Lovecraft way. I was going more like futuristic, like we could go to Mars and live there. We went two different directions, but we thought we were going the same way. That was silly.
I don't know what we're supposed to be getting out of all this, other than it's October. Or will be by the time this podcast is up for people to download, which means that it's the beginning of horror movie month.
Yes, yes. I mean, most months are that for me, but this is the month where I only...
This is true.
Unless you make me go to the theaters and see something. But,
right.
But if I have a choice, I only see horror movies.
Especially at home.
Or Halloween-themed, you know?
Right.
I let, like, some Hocus Pocus go or some stuff like that once in a while. Once in a while.
You throw a bone.
I throw a bone. So, well, you know, it depends. Some years, one year I watched, like, 130 or 140 movies in October, horror movies.
Yeah.
And one year I didn't watch very many because it was giving me, like, nightmares and I don't know why. Because that's usually not a thing, but there was just...
Your brain was making up for the horror movies you weren't seeing in real life.
Oh, maybe that's why.
So it was projecting them in your sleep instead.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. I like that theory. I'm going to adopt that.
See how easy psychoanalysis can be?
Yeah, you should. You really missed your calling. Just make shit up. You missed your calling, Cassidy.
I could still do it. There's, you know, I always drive past, like, down here in the Mar Vista, Marina Del Rey area. There's a lot of, like, touristy, weird, you know, new agey shops because it's just one of those kind of places where you buy, like, surfboards and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of like that kind of stuff, a lot of like woo going on. And there's like those like palm readers, you know, but they have like entire buildings. It's not like a Linus and Lucy lemonade stand. It's like an entire building that they pay rent for.
Well, yeah, you don't need an actual actually, you don't need a certificate or a license or anything to become a counselor, technically.
No. But what blows my mind about it is, like, how do they pay for this? Do enough people drive past that and they're like, yeah, you know what? Why not?
Yeah.
Why the hell not? And they just pull in and get their palm read on a whim?
The answer to your question, Cassidy, is yes.
I guess. I just can't imagine that that's a booming industry enough to pay, like, L.A. beachside rent.
I think you'd be surprised. There are circles, Cassidy. There are circles.
I mean, I imagine, you know, I'm not unrealistic. I imagine that each one of those places and each one of those fortune tellers probably has, like, let's say, generously, 30 regular clients who come, like, 3 days a week.
Maybe, yeah.
When they're like, a bird landed in my yard and it dropped a blue rose. What does that mean? Like, well, I imagine, you know, there's a bunch of eccentric weirdos who just have way too much money and free time.
And magical believing.
And yeah. And, but that's even that I couldn't imagine would pay them out.
But I think you'd be surprised. Those guys make a lot of money. So
maybe I should go.
You should.
And
no, I think you should. I think you should. I think you should be like the what was that documentary watch?
Which one?
That's true too. No, the Source Family.
Yeah,
you need to do one of those.
You know, there's probably still a few family members that live in this area who probably do weird shit like that.
I'm sure, but no, you need to do your own version. I mean, it has to be contemporary.
Oh, there's you remember the. I think I've maybe talked to you about this before, but remember that the douchebag from 10 Things I Hate About You?
Yeah, he has one.
He has a cult now.
You were really into that at one point.
It's just the weirdest thing, but also makes complete sense. He'd like, yeah, they'd like do drum circles and stuff over by the beach, and that's around here.
Why don't you do that? That's what I'm saying.
I could join it.
I don't join
and then
it.
And report back.
Make one.
Anything I can use for podcast fodder.
You already know what you need to do. Just do that.
Start a cult.
Yeah, just start a cult.
Okay. I'll get on that.
Thank you.
Today we're going to be reviewing Black Mass, because this is a movie review podcast. And at the end of the episode, in our Netflix homework, we're going to be reviewing the indie comedy Losers Take All. Okay, let's go ahead and move on to the movie news then. And I think you had kind of an exciting one that we got in right under the wire of last week's episode.
Oh, yeah. That Shane Carruth guy. He's actually making, like, a real big-budget Hollywood film. I mean, we'll see what that means, like, big budget. It could be just more than he's normally deals with. But it's going to be called The Modern Ocean, and it's going to be a nautical adventure. Shane Carruth, if you don't know, is the director of Primer and Upstream Color. Two really heady films that are, you know, I think beautiful to watch, but also kind of have some really interesting subject matter to read into.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure. He was trying to do another film in between here that was called A Topiary, but apparently he got this going instead, which seems pretty like normal.
The way I heard it a long time ago when he was doing press for Upstream Color,
mm-hmm,
was that he started doing Upstream Color because he was frustrated that he couldn't get A Topiary going. In fact, there's a scene in the movie of Upstream Color, if you watch it, there's a scene where Amy Simons, who plays the main character, she's a film editor in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, like, doing a little bit of editing on a computer, and there's, like, this weird-looking, like, mechanical cardboard box monster that's moving on her computer before she pauses and the scene cuts to something else.
Okay.
That is actual footage that was shot for, or test footage for, A Topiary that never got used.
Interesting.
So, I think, you know, it shows here in the same article, like, Steven Soderbergh was championing this guy and said something to the effect, like, if this were the 70s, people would be throwing money at him, and like he would give him any project he had if he had the power to do that.
Sure.
And that's kind of how I feel about this. Some people are, you know, the article, this is IndieWire, so they kind of skew a little bit more obscure, I guess. So they kind of frame it as, is Shane Carruth going to sell out? Is this the end of, you know, whatever? Is he going to be the next Joe Johnston or something?
Yeah, yes, completely. That's where it seems like it's going, because The Rocketeer is so similar to Primer. I know there's some hyperbolizing going on there, but...
I think this guy's so talented and so interesting, and is, you know, his movies, beyond the fact that they're just really good and, you know, interesting or whatever, the way he's handled his career up till now, it's been, like, as DIY as it gets for an indie filmmaker. He's done, you know, practically done everything himself, acted, directed, edited, scored, and, you know, even with Upstream Color, pretty much took care of the distribution.
Yeah.
Which meant that not a lot of people saw it, but...
Well, it's a lot of legwork. People don't really, I think, ever understand that part of the movie biz. And it's a really huge part of the movie business.
Yeah, getting people to see your movie. That's
Well, I mean, just getting it into theaters, what tracks it gets in, what medium to get to those theaters. You know, it's a huge, massive ordeal. This film is specifically, this is what he said about it. When we deal with, we're not tackling smelly and pirate angle. When we deal with the skirmishes, we know the motivation, and it's always within its set of characters. The skirmishes escalate into a full-scale naval battles using these improvised weapons on these cargo ships. So it's not trying to make a commentary about pirates. We are a world of ourselves unto ourselves in modern ocean. So
right.
It's about cargo ships battling? I don't know. It sounds kind of Waterworld-ish almost.
Maybe it's a little bit more U-571. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see.
I'm excited. Really, anything this guy wants to do. Even if he was doing Lucky Charms, the motion picture, I would see it. Because he's doing it.
Well, you're joking right now, but that's going to be... it's probably not going to be done by Shane Carruth, but that's going to be a thing with him.
I think there actually already was like an animated film that like kind of failed on arrival. Just went straight to DVD. About a bunch of mascots from different food and cereals. Like, it was like the whale from Bumblebee Tuna or whatever. Or
that's a bad one.
Yeah, and then like a few others, and they're like on an adventure together. I don't know. It was
like
poorly
the Trix
reviewed.
Rabbit versus the leprechaun from Lucky Charms. I would watch that. The death battle.
Right. I think that was an MTV show a long time ago. Okay, the story I have. The only other news story we're going to do this week, because there really hasn't been a lot, is Jake Gyllenhaal is in talks to join Benedict Cumberbatch in part of the contract with Hollywood that Benedict Cumberbatch has to be in every movie now, to play Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse, his inventor rival. And I guess the movie is going to be about the battle between Edison and Westinghouse to supply electricity, with Edison backing direct current and Westinghouse pushing alternate current. I don't know a lot about this history. Actually, I've never really heard about this Westinghouse all that much. You always hear about the battle between Edison and
Tesla.
And Tesla, because, you know, all of the weird... steampunky fan fiction that surrounds Tesla has kind of brought him back into the mainstream, and then now the electric car. But yeah, I don't know. I don't see the story here. I don't see the drama in this story, but those are two very exciting actors to be playing off of each other.
Well, maybe that's the drama you have there.
Yeah, maybe they decide to go full on The Prestige with it, and it just gets super weird.
I think that's what they should do in all films. Is just not even go, like, say, this is historical, and then it's just not historical.
By the end of the movie, they're sorcerers, and they're, like, flying in the air, like in the end of The Matrix, like, shooting lightning bolts out of their fingers.
Well, let's not go that far. Let's do Big Trouble in Little China. That's the level of special effects I want.
Okay, and that's our news. I actually had a pet topic for today. And because we're going to be reviewing Black Mass, which is Johnny Depp starring as, you know, a real life person. And maybe a little less big than some of his more recent characters. And he's being talked about in a positive way, which we haven't heard in a little while. I think just in general, Johnny Depp is a very interesting actor to talk about the arc of his career, because he's had a lot of different phases. Having started out as sort of a teen heartthrob in like 21 Jump Street and coming right off of Nightmare on Elm Street. And then kind of becoming the indie darling and starring in all these kind of awkward, strange, idiosyncratic movies in the 90s, like Dead Man and Ed Wood and whatever. And then kind of having a lull and trying to find his sea legs again in the early 2000s to rise to meteoric success with, the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and everything that's happened since. So I kind of wanted to talk about his career a little bit, but we're gonna frame it like we've done some of these directors' careers, with the best, the worst, the most underrated, and the most overrated Johnny Depp performance.
Yeah, and we're going more off of performance than maybe actually the movies themselves.
Yeah, and when talking about Johnny Depp, those two things can be very separate.
Well, that... Honestly, I have to almost kind of like preemptively say this. When we did this, I automatically went to performance. Oh, we're judging this off of performance. But this thing happened where I've named it the Johnny Depp dilemma.
Okay.
where there are films that he is in that aren't very good, but his performances are great.
Yeah, and vice versa.
And vice versa. So it's a very hard. It was actually harder than it should have been.
I agree. I kind of like, you know, I kind of thought about this and was like, oh yeah, I can throw this together in like 5 minutes. And then there was like a couple I had locked, and then the rest I was like, I don't know.
Well, the other thing too is one of them I'm picked, but I'm not proud of. It could be a game. You can wait and guess till the end which one it is.
I'm going to have to be. What category is that? We'll save that to last.
Overrated.
Okay, we'll end on overrated then. And we'll start with... Oh, Lord, how should we start this? Let's start with underrated. What, in your opinion, is the most underrated Johnny Depp performance?
Well, okay, so this is why I gave it to him. I gave his performance in this movie because a lot of people talk shit about the movie in general, but I think his performance in it makes the movie. That's Robert Rodriguez, Once Upon a Time in Mexico. Now, I feel like a lot of the controversy surrounding that, too, is more because he filmed in digital and not in film. Blah, blah, blah. But he's hilarious in that. It's not a completely... Now, he's a character in the film, but he's not like, you know, doing a Johnny Depp, Crazy House, weird character. Mm-hmm. He's a believable human. I watch that movie sometimes just to see him say some of the lines he says, like, are you a Mexican or a Mexican? His glorious racism in the movie is pretty wonderful.
I agree.
Killing everybody in the kitchen. That was a lovely scene, yeah, too.
And really out of nowhere. I agree. In fact, I agree with you so much. It is also my most underrated Johnny Depp performance.
Good.
And I think it's an underrated, unfairly maligned film as well. I don't think that it's as good as Desperado, or at least as streamlined as Desperado. To be fair, none of those movies are stellar. They got a lot of press for coming out at the right time and being part of a zeitgeist and da-da-da about independent film and, you know, being under the wing of Tarantino and all of that kind of stuff. But all of those movies, and Robert Rodriguez would be the first to admit it, are basically big, gaudy B-movies.
Yeah.
With a lot of special effects and gunplay. And for that, Once Upon a Time in the West follows suit just fine. And yes,
Once Upon a Time in Mexico.
As it were.
You said in the West.
Well, it's his ode to Once Upon a Time in the West, I suppose.
Yes.
But I think a lot of people were actually sort of disappointed with the movie because Johnny Depp is more of the center stage character than...
Antonio Banderas.
Antonio Banderas. I kept wanting to say Benicio Del Toro. And because he kind of takes the center stage of the movie, some people felt like it was sort of unfocused because he's... he's a weird sort of foil character, but that he does make the entire movie. And you're right. You're right on the nose saying that he, you know, he plays a believable human being, but he still has a ton of charisma. Like it's the right balance of what he can do with very little.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think he's totally magnetic in the film. And actually it also doesn't get enough credit because the big comeback I mentioned, like, you know, he kind of had like a rough patch there when he was like in 13th Gate and The Astronaut's Wife and, you know, some of those movies in the early 2000s, late 90s that didn't do so well.
Yeah, The Ninth Gate.
The 19th Gate, yeah.
No, The Ninth.
I'm going to, like, reach through this podcast and strangle you.
Go for it. It's The Ninth. I'm just telling you, it's The Ninth Gate.
You're right. The Polanski movie. But anyway, I believe it was, like, within the same summer, he released this movie, Once Upon a Time in Mexico, and Pirates of the Caribbean, the first one, at the same time. So his comeback was kind of a two-hander between these two performances.
Nope.
And everybody kind of gives Pirates of the Caribbean more of the credit because it had a bigger box office and had all those sequels, and the character kind of became like a well-known Disney property.
Well, it really entered the zeitgeist in a big way.
Right, but it was between the two when they came out that everyone was talking about, wow, where was Johnny Depp all this time?
Mm-hmm.
Here he is again. And yeah, I like the movie a lot. So we're going to end on Overrated. So what is, in your opinion, the worst Johnny Depp performance?
Now, just straight up performance is a little unfair. I do like the film again. I think it's Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, wow. So you're going really just on a technical basis.
Just on a technical basis. I mean, we could talk. I mean, I do have other ones. I have like, I have another one here too for that. But on a technical basis, yeah, one of his first, you know, feature length films, he was
his
not,
very first.
Yeah, exactly. He was not very good. You would not watch that movie of all the actors in it and say, oh, that guy, he's going to be a big deal someday. Like, you watch it and you go, that kid's really bad. He's going to fail into horror film hell. He'll go to horror conventions just with that one film for mm-hmm. the next 30 years.
And the people who go will be super excited because he was in that one film and died a certain way.
Right.
But in that movie, he's basically just cheesecake.
Yeah.
He's just pretty. That's his sole goal, is to be kind of innocent and pretty.
And he shows up. He's like on screen. But he's not, I mean, even doing that, he's not very good at it. So
that's an interesting way to go. I didn't think about that just because I feel like he doesn't ruin the movie. And
he doesn't, no.
It's so early in his career, like, that it's almost not even fair to fault him for that.
Well, again, I have other things written down for that. Because this got to the Johnny Depp dilemma.
No, you're totally right. And I'm going to guess that mine would have been one of your standbys on this category.
Okay, let's see.
I think the worst Johnny Depp performance is a very recent one in Kevin Smith's Tusk.
That was one of my standbys of the three. Go on. Explain.
This is the best and worst were the hardest to come up with because he's done a lot of really great work and he's done a lot of really bad work. And the thing with Johnny Depp.
But are they ever really bad performances per se?
Yeah.
Because I just see some of them I don't think are necessarily bad performances. I just think he's miscast or misused.
I think, well, here, Johnny Depp is like a loaded weapon. You know, he's gonna, him and, weirdly enough, Nick Cage are kind of similar in that they have the tools in their tool belt that they're going to use, but they desperately need directors who are going to tell them what to do and what not to do and direct them, and editors who are generous with the way they're going to shoot them, portray them, and direct them. And I think that Unchecked, especially lately, in the like latter half of Johnny Depp's career, post Pirates of the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
He he'll go places and do these wild things, which is a good thing to do as an actor. It's better to be big and need to be tampered down than to be down and need to be bolstered up. It's a lot harder to go up, to teach an actor to go up, than it is to teach an actor to go down.
Right.
So it's a good thing, and it's the thing that makes him good when he is good. But the problem is he's such a huge star, and people feel so lucky to have him in his movie, especially somebody like Kevin Smith, who's making this really small, weird, idiosyncratic horror comedy, which we could go into the problems of that movie in general and him just being a symptom of it. But to me, it is emblematic of everything that Johnny Depp does wrong as an actor now. I could have said Mordecai, but I didn't see that movie. But to me, that, like, from the trailers, looked like more of the same.
See, I think I mostly agree with you. I think that Tusk actually would have been a good movie if you would have taken his part out and added some, because you ask a lot of these questions with some of these characters and then you never answer them. Mm-hmm. But he's there. He doesn't make sense in comparison to every single other character there.
Well, he's by far, he is the point in which the shark jumps, or the, yeah, it's so bad the shark actually jumps the ramp himself.
Yes.
The shark jumps the shark with that performance in that movie. But so that was what I had to go for. I could have gone for Mad Hatter, but a part of me was like, you know what? Who knows what that performance is underneath all that makeup and all that CGI and all that everything. I don't even know what that performance
is. Well, that story in general. I mean, that's another Johnny Depp dilemma. That's a Burton Depp dilemma.
Right. So I feel like this one is a lot more concentrated in that we can just look at the performance.
That was my third one, though, is the Alice in Wonderland one, because it's annoyingly just like, what the hell are you doing here?
Right. And also the way he's integrated in the story and everything. So, yeah.
Well, I think he is a really charismatic guy. So I think sometimes when he comes in and does these big characters, I think maybe some directors just don't know what to do. Like, they just go, oh, okay. And so you're on set and you're watching it. But then you get back to like the editing and you're like, oh, shit. What do I do with all this? I can't get him again. He's booked. What do I do? And so you have to do something with it. But I don't know.
All right. Well, going in the opposite direction, what would you say is the best Johnny Depp performance?
Again, this got weird because are we talking like Johnny Depp being like a nuanced performance, a big performance? So I just kind of went the middle ground and I picked one of my favorite of his movies that where I think he's used well, and it's just a good movie altogether with his performance included in it, if that makes sense.
Right.
I picked Ed Wood.
That would have been a very tempting choice for me as well, but that's not what I picked. But go ahead and explain why.
So in that film, he does do a weird idiosyncratic performance. Mm-hmm. However, in juxtaposition to everything else that's going on and what the actual subject matter is, it makes complete sense.
Yeah.
But there's also some lovely, like, nuanced, like, parts in it. Like, there's the scene that kind of always is kind of heartbreaking where it's just him watching this little thing of Bela Lugosi just, like, coming out of his house and I think smell the flowers or something like that.
Yeah, it's this tiny little reel. Yeah.
And that's the only really emotional, like, thing that happens within that whole context. But it's heartbreaking and it's a nuanced moment within this big character. So I think it's kind of an underrated movie too, that people usually don't point at and say, look, this is a good one. It's just an entertaining movie about a strange director done by a strange director by a strange actor. I like it.
Yeah, it completely works. Everything about that movie is right on. And that's sort of why I didn't pick it, as I think that the performance is good for that movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think you could take that exact same performance and place it out of context with a different director, a different direction.
Sure.
And I don't know that it's hard for me to really gauge
that's
how good that performance is, because that it's also part and parcel to the style of the movie.
And I don't think you're wrong. Again, that's why specifically with my criteria, I was like, well, it's because the director is not only, he's also using the performance to its strength, not right, just because you can later look at Tim Burton's like Sleepy Hollow, which he's not as much of that of a character. He's actually kind of more of a straight man in that movie specifically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a little weird, but not, you know.
Sure. Yeah. Actually, that's a sort of an underrated film as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I believe me, I really wanted to pick Ed Wood because I love that movie.
Well, see, I got two for you.
But I didn't, because in my opinion, and this is a movie I've not seen that much. I think I've only seen it once. And I would watch Ed Wood 500 times before seeing this other movie again, which isn't to say it's bad. I just love Ed Wood that much more. I picked his performance from Blow.
Okay.
Which was a totally committed, realistic portrayal. This, again, was sort of in that weird lull period where his movies weren't doing that well. This was sort of critically loved, as well as Donnie Brasco. This sort of was around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Where both are really good performances, actually. But I feel like Donnie Brasco is a little bit more kind of like, I'm tough New Yorker, and which is a little easier to do what he had to do in Blow, which is to play, you know, the movie goes over a long span of time. It starts in when he's a really young drug dealer in the early, late 60s, early 70s, all the way through to like the early 90s, I think. So he has to age, and that in general is really hard to do convincingly, mm-hmm. but he pulls that off completely. And I feel like his character just has a lot to do in that, because it is kind of a rousing sort of drug dealing comedy in that sort of like Scorsese-ish Goodfellas sort of way. But then it's also, becomes a very, tense drama towards the middle when you're dealing with like, Penelope Cruz is like trying to take his kid away. And then, you know, he has to like sell himself out to be able to see his daughter. And so there's a lot going on dramatically. And like I said, it's the movie itself is good, but I don't think great for that genre. I think it's like fine, but his performance on it, I think, is maybe the most nuanced stuff he's done and showed the most range within like a relatable, not just, you know, putting on a hat and dancing around weird kind of performance. Like it's maybe his most interior performance outside of, I don't know, something like Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is you could put a lot of underrated performances, because there's a lot of malign movies he's in now that I realize in looking at his list. Because I'd also, because another like more nuanced character I would say is Public Enemies, that I really loved, but whatever. I haven't seen Blow, so.
Oh, you should.
Okay, I will.
Yeah.
One day.
It's kind of like Boogie Nights light, but it's still pretty good.
Hmm.
Okay, so you said you had a big wazoo on this one.
I don't think it's a very good choice. I basically chose it because, well, first of all, I just had a hard time because I kept coming up with all, but what about this? But what about this? But what if this happened? But what about this?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I just, there were some that I just, it was a never ending, just snafu of choices. So I just picked a movie that I was like, oh, I kind of remember people liking this one, and I kind of just think it's a kind of a boring movie. Chocolat.
For most overrated?
Yes. I don't think it's a very good choice. And I just think he's pretty in it. That's pretty much what they used him. They're like, Johnny Depp's pretty, and we put him in the film. And yeah.
To play the most charismatic and freewheeling gypsy of all time.
I don't know if that's true. Honestly, it's kind of funny because, like, I would say that's almost kind of a, all right. I can't think of his name. That's all I could think of.
Matthew McConaughey,
yeah. He might as well be a Matthew McConaughey love interest.
You know, you're not wrong. I think it's a fair choice. I think that what's weird about that movie for me, and I didn't even think about it, when I was putting together this list.
Mm.
I think Johnny Depp is very much just a serviceable actor in the movie. I don't think that I don't even really think about him in it when I think about the movie, even though he's a sizable part of the movie. But I feel like that is, you know, so much Juliette Binoche's movie.
Well, I think I chose that because,
and he is pretty much just sort of a love interest.
Well, honestly, the reason I wasn't proud of my entry here also was because I think it was just because I was raised by like a lot of women. And so like, maybe this is being sexist, I don't know, but around me, you know, a lot of, they're like, oh, it's such a good movie. It's such a good movie. And then, you know, lo and behold, I watched the movie and I'm like, okay, whatever. So I don't know. I'm not sure. Honestly, yeah. I just found it kind of boring.
I think there's some things about the movie that's kind of interesting. Actually, my favorite performance is Alfred Molina in that movie. Essentially playing John Lithgow from Footloose. Essentially, it's Footloose. That movie's Footloose.
with like, baking.
Replace dancing with chocolate, and it's the same fucking movie. I don't know. It's sweet. It's fine. Lassie Hallström, you know, he went from making movies like What's Eating Gilbert Grape, which is actually a pretty good Johnny Depp performance, and then this, and then he's made, like, become more and more kind of sentimental Hallmark Channel crap, like doing Nicholas Sparks movies and that kind of stuff. And there's a seed of the Nicholas Sparks thing in Chocolat.
Hmm.
So it's a good bridge movie to what he was and what he's become.
Yeah. I'm not proud of it, but it's what I chose for overrated just because of a specific time in my life.
Right.
Not necessarily his overall career.
My most overrated performance from Johnny Depp mm-hmm. is another Burton pick, and that is Sweeney Todd. I was pretty excited about Sweeney Todd when it first came out. I hadn't completely given up on Tim Burton, and this was before Tim Burton started making kind of okay movies again. But I kind of liked, you know, the stills I was seeing, and everyone loved the musical and talked about how, you know, violent it was and how dark and whatever. It was R-rated, which I thought was kind of interesting, and I know Johnny Depp was doing his own singing and da-da-da. I go see the movie, and I felt like that was not only such an empty movie, but a really boring performance. I felt like it was so one-note. It was so built upon his costume and sort of all of the exteriors of what that movie was in general. Like, the whole thing to me just felt like Hot Topic the motion picture. And nothing about it really resonated. I didn't, like, even like, yeah, people are turning into meat pies and getting their throat slit and all this stuff and all these musical numbers. And I just, like, the whole thing to me was just felt light as a feather. I just did not care. And the worst thing you could say about a Johnny Depp performance is that it just doesn't resonate at all. Because even when he goes off the rails, at least you can, like, hate it with some amount of fervor, like I did with Tusk. But Sweeney Todd is just, it was like a rice wafer of a movie.
Maybe, yeah. I watched it. I don't really remember it. Mm-hmm. I see, the thing is I had read the stage play and I'd seen the stage play. So, and they always do the stage play kind of happy, even though really bad things are happening. And so it sort of gives it a different, like, flavor. Just a different ambiance. This one was pretty dour. And so I feel like that was kind of part of the problem, is just because there was no kind of life to it, really.
Yeah.
I just felt like a cardboard cutout. But, I think it's a decent choice. It just depends on what, like, logical, like, whatever logical conundrum you come to with this, because basically you're saying it's probably an okay performance by this guy, but this is why I think it's his worst performance.
I don't think it's his worst. I put it in my overrated category because I think it just doesn't do anything in one direction or another. It's so beholden to the all the exteriors, including his costume, the music, the production design, which is a thing you could say about a lot of Johnny Depp, Tim Burton collaborations. But I just didn't love it. I didn't hate it either. I just kind of walked away with like a shrug. And then I knew a lot of people who were sort of my age, and then especially some who are a little bit younger, more like your wife's age, who loved that movie. It became like, you know, the theater geeks kind of movie. And I was just like, I guess.
I've kind of heard of like a more positive sentiments within certain groups, but I just was like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
It should have been right up my alley. And honestly, again, The only reason it wasn't was because I don't think it would have even if I didn't, because I tried to get that to be one of the play that we did
for high musical school.
In high school, but
yeah, that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
Which is probably good because we ended up accidentally hanging someone. We didn't need to accidentally cut somebody's throat.
You know, you say that. But the person who we almost would have killed in that one would have lived too. So, would have been fine.
All right, let's go ahead and get on with our review of Black Mass, which is the latest Johnny Depp performance. Okay, so Black Mass is directed by Scott Cooper, who also did Out of the Furnace last year and Crazy Heart, which got a decent amount of attention got an Oscar nomination out of Jeff Bridges.
Right.
This is the real life story of the gangster Whitey Bulger from Boston, which was a character that sort of appeared in sort of a facsimile in Martin Scorsese's The Departed, played by Jack Nicholson. Of course, that movie was sort of a hybrid between actual events and then the remake of Infernal Affairs from Hong Kong. And this movie is so, you know, if you look at that as kind of like being the hyper-stylized Martin Scorsese, you know, cops and robbers movie, this is sort of the real-life version of it. And it sort of plays like that, too. It follows Whitey Bulger's career and how he eventually becomes an informant for the FBI, and him and Joel Edgerton, who plays John Connolly, they kind of came up in the streets together, the Southies in Boston. And the movie kind of makes the argument, in my opinion, that Joel Edgerton is sort of a gangster in his own right. He's just a gangster for the FBI instead of a gangster on the streets. And so it kind of becomes this almost sort of like Michael Mann examination of the police versus the world of the police versus the world of the criminal, and how this relationship develops over a series of years where Whitey Bulger becomes the most powerful thing in Boston. What did you think of Black Mass?
No, I'm not very into it, actually. I'm just going to be very blunt. The whole time I kept thinking about Johnny Depp and his performance. That's what was funny about this, your overrated, underrated thing.
Well, there might have been a reason I picked it.
Yeah, I referred to him as the Boston version of Dracula throughout the whole movie.
I thought a lot about, maybe, I don't know, it could have been part because of the makeup, but I thought a lot about Bram Stoker's Dracula, the Coppola movie.
Oh, I was just being mean in like the Bela Lugosi kind of, the hair, the way it was shot. I mean, just how his character came across, like, they're... At first, they kind of humanize him, and then it goes on. He just becomes kind of, it doesn't feel like a real person. It feels like a monster, like a blank slated Dracula type monster, which works fine within horror because horror is talking about a larger context of fear. But in this, it just was like, this is supposed to be a guy, but it doesn't feel like a guy. This movie also is just weird just because it's like, it's that guy movie. It seems like every bit part is played by somebody. Adam Scott's in there. He's one of those that is just
he
like...
He sure is.
He does like five lines and...
he does a lot of mustache acting.
He does. I don't know. This film, I don't think needed to happen. I think you brought up The Departed, which I think is a much more interesting movie because it's trying to be a film. I think this would be more interesting if it was just like a history biography. And they had crappy actors instead of every interesting actor that's come up in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And they just gave you all the information on top of the horrible performances. I would have preferred that because half the time I was wondering, well, when does this take place and what's the importance? Well, the Johnny Depp aging stuff, he's supposed to be aging, but I don't see him aging. He just seems kind of baldish the whole movie.
Which adds to his vampiric quality.
Yes. Yes. And the contacts don't help.
We should mention, you mentioned the giant cast. We got Benedict Cumberbatch in here. Again, part of his contract to be in every movie ever.
Right.
Dakota Johnson is in here for a little while. Kevin Bacon, Peter Sarsgaard, Jesse Plemons, Rory Cochrane, who actually, he's the character I believe the most, and I think gives the best performance that's not going to be talked about this year.
Let me see who, I don't know who that is.
Rory Cochrane.
Okay, yeah, I see who he is. He does give a good performance.
He was like in Empire Records and...
Yeah.
And Dazed and Confused and da-da-da. I go to his, like, first two movies.
Well, you're not done, because there's Adam Scott, Corey Stoll, W.E. Earl Brown, who's the scary dude from, and I mean, he's a scary dude in this too, but he was a scary dude from Deadwood, Juno Temple. Like,
yeah.
Like, the list goes on and on. I'm sure if I kick C full cast, I'm sure there would be more interesting people in here.
And there's pockets of interesting performances along the way. You don't have that many talented people and get nothing out of it.
Oh, right.
I just feel like the movie as a whole is so... I found, like, it just completely lacked drama. There was very charismatic actors. There was some decent one-on-one direction. Where I think that Scott Cooper as a director excels is on scenes with... very intimate scenes with very few people in the frame. Whenever there was like a one-on-one or like a conversation set piece or something like that, I think that's where he excels. He has a little bit of a harder time, I think, with the big picture stuff, with the macro scale movie stuff.
Sure.
And there's, I felt like, you know, I was wondering, like, what is this movie? Where's the emotional engine here? Because I don't, if it's supposed to be, and what I eventually came to the conclusion, it's supposed to be about the relationship between Johnny Depp and Joel Edgerton and like how they don't want to sell each other out. And they have this kind of marriage made in hell, between the two. And they're both kind of compromising their thing for the other side. Like that's the movie. That's
Did you come to that? I'm being facetious, but I'm kind of being serious.
I came to that because that's all there is.
Right.
Ultimately, that's the story, and that's supposed to be the emotional arc. And I never really felt it, because I think a big problem with this movie is I don't think that Johnny Depp and Joel Edgerton have that much chemistry. And I don't feel their relationship. I don't feel their history. They talk about it.
And
in the same breath, I don't feel like Joel Edgerton and Benedict Cumberbatch are supposed to be playing brothers. I don't buy them for a second being related, for one.
Well, their relationships seem just as cool. Like, cool. When they're, like, some of the
cool, you know, as in not hot in temperature, or cool as in, like, neato?
Cool, not as in neato. Not as in either of those. Cool as in demeanor.
Right. And part of that is the style of the movie. I get that it wants to be a little bit more low-key, and it wants to kind of simmer instead of explode, and that's fine, but there's a lot of things going on here with the interactions between the actors where the emotional stuff just isn't happening, and so I don't ever really feel any stakes in, like, oh, is Joel Edgerton gonna get caught? I don't care, he's kind of a dirtbag. Is Johnny Depp gonna get caught by the police? Like, hopefully he does, I don't know. The Dakota Johnson is actually really terrible in this movie.
Which one did she
the 50 Shades of Grey girl. And
I know, but which one was she in the movie?
She played his first wife, or his wife in the movie.
The Whitey Bulger character?
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
Right. And then every time there was an interesting character who pops on screen for like a few seconds, you're like, oh, okay. And then they'd like die the next scene.
Hmm.
Or
they just go away and never come back.
I just felt like there was no forward momentum here. It just kind of went from one thing to another. It's a little bit of a rise and fall story, but you don't even get that, like, kind of Goodfellas rousing, perversion of the American experience thing. Like, it just kind of sits there.
No, absolutely true. One of the things I thought about that, I really liked Corey Stoll for the 5 seconds he was in the
film. He was really good in it. Part of the fun thing for him to do in that movie is he gets to basically say everything the audience is thinking up to that point.
Right.
And so he gets to just stomp into the movie and do his thing. And yeah, well, he's a lot of fun.
I wonder if a lot of these actors though felt like that they were putting together something really well. Cause I feel like they're all kind of doing their thing.
Yeah.
But they're like, oh, we're working with all these great actors. It's gotta be great. But then there's no actual narrative to it. And not even just narrative. There's no backbone. there's no anything. You said connective tissue, which I think works too, but there's just, it's just blah, like throughout most of it to me.
You gave a very similar review to last year's Out of the Furnace.
I was not a huge fan of that film, and I didn't care about that film either. Throughout the whole thing, I was just like, okay.
I kind of liked that movie a little bit more because I felt like there was kind of like a, like an old school noir revenge thing going there. Some genre stuff I could attach myself to. And there should be here too, because it's a gangster film and people are getting their heads blown off every other scene.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. To me, I don't know if it was sort of Scott Cooper's vision for what he wanted this to be. It's sort of, you know, sort of a docudrama in some ways, but Johnny Depp, we can talk about the performance. I actually think that he's doing fine, but that the makeup choices are so distracting. You know, the blue eyes, which just look totally...
They're a little too blue.
Well, it looks like makeup. And when
a vampire, that's where I kept going.
Right. He did. And maybe that's kind of, you could argue, someone probably has, that that's what they're going for, that he is this Dracula sucking the life out of the city kind of thing. To me, it was just too much. And I felt like actually his performance was good enough on its own that he didn't need that.
And I think in places it was. This movie to me was all over the place. There were scenes where I literally felt like even these great actors were turning in crappy performances.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. I never really felt all that much about Joel Edgerton in the movie.
It depended. I thought the stuff with his wife was kind of resonant. Like, I got those scenes.
Yeah, actually, what's her name? Because she's really good in this.
I want to say it's
Julianne Nicholson?
Yeah, she was decent.
Yeah, she was really fun. Again, like the Corey Stoll character, she's thinking what the audience is thinking.
Or Peter Sarsgaard. I really liked him, too.
Peter Sarsgaard was really good. Actually, that whole little sequence with him,
mm-hmm.
that was, to me, like, I felt like a movie was starting. And then it ended just as quickly.
Right.
So I don't know. Yeah, I don't think this isn't like a, you know, run for the hills kind of awful movie. Like, you know, avoid it by all means, avoid it. Like, I think it's fine. But it's not that exciting. And honestly, you know, a lot of people give a lot of shit, like post-Oscar win shit to The Departed because they're like, oh, Infernal Affairs was obviously superior and they just gave it to Scorsese because they felt like he needed an award for not getting him for Taxi Driver and Goodfellas and blah, blah, blah. And no, that movie is inherently more interesting and has all the forward momentum that this movie doesn't have.
It did everything this movie wanted to do, but didn't do. Like, right. This one wanted to be more realistic, but was less realistic. That one was more truthfully, emotional truthful. This film might have been better with dates or times, maybe, but nobody cares. I think if you're like a gangster film aficionado, then maybe you'll get something out of this. But I really think it's just kind of dour and kind of
bland.
Honestly, just bland enough that it might as well just be as like the worst movie you've ever seen, because it's just kind of, why am I watching this? That's the whole time I was bored. Anytime I'm starting to name characters like
name actors.
Well, calling them like Boston Dracula, anything like that. I'm entertaining myself.
Right.
That's a bad sign in a film. If I'm taken away completely and I'm not doing any of that, that's good. But I can't endorse this unless you're a big aficionado of this. I guess I could see some validity in you going and seeing it, but you've seen better. Just go watch The Departed again.
Right, just go watch The Departed. And then if you're because a part of me feels like he's kind of going for this kind of like existential, you know, weighty sort of Godfather thing, but The Godfather does this movie better. Like, there's nothing I see here that hasn't been done better in other movies. Like, it is on a genre level, the movie is kind of, it's just kind of tepid, everything about it.
Mm-hmm. I think he's a newer director that got thrown into the deep end really quick.
You could be right. And I feel like he needs a much smaller canvas. That's why I think Crazy Heart of the three movies works the best.
Because he has it. It's a more small movie.
Yeah, it's a character study. Sure. But yeah, I don't know. I don't hate this movie. I don't even necessarily not recommend it. But it's not really doing anything particularly interesting.
I just blah this movie.
Yeah. All right. You saw a movie I did not see.
I did.
You saw a little horror film called Cooties, which I actually wanted to see, but I'm going to have to wait probably a little bit longer before I can see it. But we're not going to wait for the review.
No, Cooties is a film. It's done. It's the first film of Jonathan Mallott and Carrie Mernon. It's based off of a short, and then they got the funding to do a bigger film. It stars Elijah Wood, Rainn Wilson, Allison Peele, Jack McBrayer. It has a bigger cast too. Jorge Garcia, the guy from Lost, the chubby charismatic, charismatic guy. It's kind of like a play on the genre, because usually you have students who figure out that their faculty are like taken over by monsters, like the movie The Faculty that Elijah Wood was in. Yes. Or any many of those variations. But it's usually, in this one, it's a little different because the school staff, they see that the kids have become blood-sucking, horrible little zombie-like monsters. This film is a pretty decent horror comedy. I found it to be really fun. Specifically, it tended to be better at being funny than scary. That kind of jumps... towards the end, they have these really atmospheric scenes that actually do work and are kind of tense. Mm-hmm. It's basically what you follow is this. There's this guy who goes back to his hometown, is living with his mom, and he's played by Elijah Wood, who it's his first day of teaching summer school, and he's kind of getting to know and get acquainted with the different staff, whether that's Allison Peele, who's like your very typical, like, overly positive teacher. Yeah. But it's like fake. She plays a real character in this. Like, it's not a very nuanced performance. But at first I was kind of like, I don't know if I'm really into this. But by the end I was like, oh, I see what she's doing and it completely works.
It sounds kind of similar to a character from Snowpiercer.
In a way, yeah. It's kind of a continuation of that character. Maybe not as verbose.
Right.
maybe a little bit more nuanced, but not much. But then you've got Rainn Wilson, who's playing like right-wing... douchebag, former college football player or whatever, kind of. And he's basically the gym teacher.
Right.
And they kind of have these kind of debates and stuff, and there's this weird love triangle between the three of them. But it ends up breaking down throughout a zombie apocalypse where it just hits children.
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
Okay.
I know that this movie actually came out kind of a long time ago, or was made a long time ago. Mm-hmm. It premiered at Sundance, not this last winter, but the winter before it.
Right.
And it took a long time for it to get distribution because there was some squeamishness around the idea of killing kids in a school because of Sandy Hook that happened kind of recently.
Oh, okay.
And so it took a while to find distributions. How do they deal with, you know, by the time we're seeing the movie now... How do they go pretty full on with the killing kids stuff?
Yeah, but I mean,
I know I feel that like there's comedy, but
it's hard for me too because there's such a level of separation because they become zombies. So it's like, right. Yeah, you kill them. But yeah, they're just full on hitting and killing kids. Like, I mean, it
so
kind
it goes
of,
for it.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of allusions to like Evil Dead and Christine, and it makes what's the other allusion? It made some Dead Alive references. I mean, it very much knows what it's doing.
Right.
I mean, this isn't like, I would say this is somewhere, if I'm trying to give you a scale of how good it is, it's somewhere between, so like, not as good as Cabin in the Woods, but better than like Tucker and Dale. So it's pretty decent.
Okay. Yeah.
So that,
I really like both of those movies.
I did too, but it's like right in between there in quality. And I would say for a first time filmmaker's movie, this is really, it's a lot of fun. And again, the comedy... maybe it's just some of the people they had, because they had people like Rainn Wilson and Jack McBrayer, but that really works. And they do some like return humor, like callback humor, like Arrested Development kind of does.
Yeah.
And they do some like teacher humor, and there's a lot of really fun performances here. But if you're going in for the gore factor, or you like the idea of people killing kids, this is a fun movie.
All right.
Like, I don't, there's no way to undersell or oversell this movie. You're either going to like it or you're not.
It's either your thing or it isn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, if it is your thing, then the description should have sold it to you. But as for the description selling it, it's still pretty decent even beyond that. Like, it's not just all concept. It's not just throwaway. There is some concept stuff. Like, I thought you were going to ask me a question. There's a political kind of like subtext to it, but it doesn't ever really pay off. So it's just kind of like, okay, whatever. But it's there and it kind of does it in that Romero sort of subtexty horror way.
Well, what I mean by all concept is that, there's a lot of movies that just like, especially these low budget kind of horror things where I feel like they think, you know, they just come up with a wacky idea and then they just kind of go with it. And they, you know, just kind of let the movie write itself from there. And it just ends up kind of being like fun, but ultimately forgettable. You would say this is a little better than that.
I would say it's a little better than that. This is overall more of a comedy. See, there's horror comedy and then there's comedy horror. I think you have to kind of, and this is more of a comedy horror, but, it definitely does the violence. It definitely has a lot of fun moments. Some of them are kind of eye rolling. I mean, it has a few issues, but I would say overall, when I got done with the movie, I was like, that was a lot of fun. And I really enjoyed it. And it definitely doesn't make any reservations about saying like, hey, we're like these 30 other movies. So right. I know sometimes you don't like self-referential stuff. They do that a lot.
It depends. That's actually a decent segue into Losers Take All.
Sure.
Losers Take All is our Netflix homework, which you assigned me. This is definitely a grab bag, because I don't think either of us had really heard about this. This is kind of newish. This came out in 2011 and stars Kyle Gallner, who I think some people might have seen. He's kind of one of those it guys you see in movies every once in a while. He was in the most recent Nightmare on Elm Street remake, and he was in Dear White People.
I think he got that because he was a pretty big character in Veronica Mars for a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
He played Beaver in that.
He comes from the world of TV. Yeah.
Yeah.
The basic plot here is this is a period comedy. This takes place in the mid to late 80s during the time. One of my favorite eras of music, actually, is during the... that kind of weird growing pains era between American hardcore and the indie alternative rock thing in the early 90s, when a lot of bands were trying to find their sea legs and sort of find an identity and sort of mixing styles and blah, blah, blah. Kyle Gallner and his best friend, played by Aaron Himmelstein, they are these kind of punk rock losers who are trying to get noticed or whatever, but they need a backing band or the rest of the components of their four piece, and they find these two metalhead kind of Hesher stoner types who lose their lead singer, and they're looking for a band, and even though they don't have a lot in common, they kind of come together to hash it out musically and sort of work out their differences, and they create this band called The Fingers somewhere in the Midwest, and they're trying to just get off the ground and kind of get noticed, and they end up meeting a band manager who's also sort of a loser who just lost his band, and he, you know, sort of unwittingly gets them into a few gigs here or there, puts them on tour, which doesn't go so well, and it's sort of just a conversational comedy-ish lazy sort of, I don't know. This is produced in part, I think, by Kevin Smith and his people.
Mm.
His name is on it somewhere. And so I feel like his brand is sort of on this. This very much wants to be part of the canon of sort of the early 90s Kevin Smith indie thing.
Well, it does feel, beyond just being attached to Kevin Smith, it feels kind of like that. Because
it has that sort of Mallrats, Clerks-ish sort of Gen X-y thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can't say that it's a particularly great film. I think that the writing is not that strong. You know, if you're talking about just a movie to stand on its own with dialogue, the dialogue's not that good.
Mm-hmm.
The acting's fine, not particularly stand out either. It's not shot particularly with any kind of ambition. Actually, I kind of felt like these characters made this movie.
Right.
Like, and in a way, in a weird way, that sort of is the best thing about it, is that it's so unassuming.
Yeah.
And it's so kind of lazy that it's like, yeah, fuck you. This is the movie I'm going to be. If you don't like it, I kind of don't care.
Well, it's sort of a weird, it's sort of weird because I kind of like the movie, but I kind of don't think it's very good.
Yeah, I kind of came around to it. Like, I was in the beginning of the movie, I was sort of like, I don't know if I'm that into this. And then, like, by the end of the movie, I was just sort of like, I was just like, you know what? Good for these guys.
I see. I was like, I think mine was midway, because at the start I wasn't sure about it, and by the end I wasn't sure about it, because I think the ending is really super weak.
Yeah, it kind of like has to wrap up, but it sort of wraps up in the way you know it's going to.
I don't. Well, yeah, but it still doesn't kind of work, and I don't know how that happened, but because it's just sort of like, and then it ends, and you're like, okay, thank you. You should have just stopped at some point. There are characters that don't have any point. Like, there's this character played by Tania Raymonde, Wendy Horowitz. She's like this other record producer person.
Yeah.
She has no point. Her character serves the movie not at all and doesn't even need to be there.
Right.
The comedy doesn't really work in it at all, but the drama, that's where I was weirded out, is like the comedy to me didn't find it almost funny at all. But like, yeah, kind of the dramatic resonance, I was kind of like, yeah, I sort of get that. And so I was wondering if it was just a me thing. Like, if it was just like, I came out of a particular time where these kind of films were kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Slash maybe I just have kind of an in because like, I'm kind of into the music scene of that era as well. Mm-hmm. Like so I wasn't sure if it was like, I kind of just was okay with the film because of that, or if there was something there. But like I said, I think that the drama, the resonance of the drama actually does work in the film.
Well, I mean, there's some interpersonal stuff between the band members where they're talking about, like, you know, there's kind of like a little bit in here in this movie between the two main characters, Kyle Gallner, the other guy.
Sure. Aaron Himmelstein.
Aaron Himmelstein. There's a bit between there where they're like, you know, they're both sort of jockeying for who's the songwriter of the band. And yeah. There's a little bit of jealousies there, like creative jealousies there, and sort of a power thing going on that's pretty subtle. And I think played just as much as it needs to play. But it also, I don't feel like the movie's really counting on that to drive the film. Mm. Like, the movie never becomes about that.
Well, okay, so the band manager that we were talking about, going back to that, played by Adam Hersher, yeah, named Greg, annoying as shit. I didn't like his character.
I thought he was a bit too much. I felt like the movie was sort of mocking the character for no reason.
Right.
I felt like it. To me, it was that weird kind of squeamish, I don't know, Revenge of the Nerds kind of over the top sort of thing that just, I don't know. Yeah, I wasn't into it. Like, they did some interesting things with the character here or there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some times where I felt like the actor was like fighting for, you know, some sort of personality outside of just this broad comedy thing.
Well, that's the thing, is like, I didn't know. It was weird because it kept shifting between like kind of an actual like dramatic arc.
Yeah, or and an arch performance. He would be, yeah, and then sometimes he would just become Booger from Off Dead.
That's a good.
Yeah, I don't know. It was as a whole, I can't like fully recommend the movie. I think it's kind of, it is lazy, and not just because it intentionally wants to sort of be like, you know,
it's being a grab bag. It's a grab bag sort of movie too. Like,
right,
if we're going to continue with that lazy metaphor.
And kind of like Black Mass, when I look at it and I can see the movie's antecedents,
mm-hmm,
I feel like everything, all of its cinematic references are better than it.
True.
I think that, you know, you look at something like SLC Punk is wildly better than this movie. You look at something like Clerks or Dazed and Confused, whatever, any of those kind of 90s
slacker films,
you know, teen comedies. Yeah, they're all much better than this one.
Agreed.
But I did kind of have a soft spot for it just because I did grow up during that era. I did watch those movies and sort of like them, even some of the bad ones.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me of like those kind of movies that came out during that time. So if you're super nostalgic for like mid-90s alterna stuff.
Well, I think it would have even looked better if it would have been shot during those periods.
Well,
because
yeah.
It would have been on film versus digital.
And digital, some of the digital kind stuff of flattens out the movie in a weird way.
Yeah. And sometimes you're like, this almost feels a little too real than it should. But I don't know. It was, again, I appreciate what you, and I completely agree with what you're saying. If you have a penchant for any of these things, then this film might work for you. If you don't, it's not very good. Don't watch it.
Yeah. And then if you are sort of somewhat interested in this era of music, it's sort of a love letter to it in a way that drifts off and on into obnoxiousness.
Well, it doesn't necessarily inform anything about the era. It just is kind of set there. And
right. If you know some things about it, though, the relationship between the two main characters reminded me a bit of the relationship between the two main songwriters from Dinosaur Jr.
Right.
Musically, they sound a lot like The Replacements, and there's a lot of references to The Replacements and Husker Du and the Minneapolis scene.
Sure.
So, and, you know, at one point they end up in the 930 Club in D.C. So there's a lot of, like if you've read Mike Osorod's Our Band Could Be Your Life, then...
Or and if I you've have. Just, or you've just, I haven't read it, but I was familiar with a lot of the references still.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, if you're into this,
if
that
if
era.
If you grew up during that time or you were obsessed with that sort of music, it pays a lot of lip service to it.
And if you're having
it oscillates between being endearing and annoying.
If you're having a grab bag night, maybe just throw it in because it's, I don't know, it's not very good. I can't really recommend it, but I can't really say I disliked it that much. It's just one of those movies.
It's the Kraft Singles grilled cheese sandwich of movie.
Yes. Like sometimes you just eat it because it's there.
Yeah, because it's easy and it's quick and it's just good enough.
Right.
All right. Next week is the first week of the horror month. And everything we're going to be reviewing in the Netflix homework is going to be of the horror persuasion. And there's a movie on there I've been meaning to watch for a while. A British film came out, I think, last year or the year before, called Barbarian Sound Studio.
Mm.
And that'll be the first movie that kicks off our horror movie Netflix homework.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited. Me too. I've been meaning to watch it.
If anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about today, what's your favorite Johnny Depp performances, or do you have any opinion about that? I'm sure you might. If you saw Black Mass and disagree with us or agree with us, or if you happen to catch Losers Take All or you know somebody who was in it, go ahead and email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. Go ahead and, oh, I forgot. We have an email this week.
Do we have an email? I think you forgot because we usually don't.
I know. That's how that's how unbelievable it is. We ask people to send us our email, and then I almost forgot to read it. Our love affair with Patrick over at Make Dad Read Comics continues. He sent us an email, and I think he caught up with a lot of episodes sort of recently because he kind of jumps around from concept to concept. And I actually had to like stop and think about it. I was like, wait a minute, did I talk about that? And then I was like, oh no, that was like two episodes prior. But here we go. He wants to say, fellows, first off, I was upset that you did go away from the Netflix homework. Yeah, like three episodes ago, we delayed the homework for a week.
I didn't do shit.
And you were on top of it. It was all me. But I did like the journey down memory lane. We had a discussion about movies we weren't allowed to see as kids. In which you were allowed to see everything and I wasn't.
Yeah, it became a very different. Yeah, that's a weird conversation. I couldn't see this. Oh, I saw this film and I shouldn't have.
That was the conversation. Yeah. It says, Cassidy, I also could not watch television until age 10, other than the news or sports. No dogmatic reasons, but because my mother is a quasi-bohemian and felt television was some type of right-wing weapon or something. She's not probably wrong. Not wrong about that. I was totally allowed to see TV. I don't know if I said that in the episode. I was a TV kid. A lot of my memories are very much tied to what was I watching at that time. But yes, I understand what you're saying here.
It's weird that you're not a better TV watcher because of that.
I know. You think I would be. Mm. I went the other way. Movies were fine, and my dad would take me to any random film he wanted to see. I saw Do the Right Thing, Die Hard, The Accused, Coming to America, and many more at age 8 and 9 on first run. I don't know if my 9-year-old brain could have handled Do the Right Thing, but I don't know. Might have taught me something.
I think I probably actually caught it on HBO or something, and I'm fine. I don't remember it.
He says, I like your Swedish and Norwegian theory. This I mentioned on the last episode. If I were surrounded by snow and cold, I may not commit many homicides because it's too damn cold, but I would fantasize about it often. So I mentioned in the last episode that despite the fact that Sweden and Norway are very safe and very progressive areas, that their fiction is often really dark and murderous.
Well, what else would you do?
Exactly. You get bored.
Yeah.
He says, I echo every single point you made about the visit. It was very it had very unsettling points, decent jump scares, decent twist. He said, yes, those children were supposed to be comic relief, but they were just wasted film space and not endearing.
Yep.
And he also says, I also loathe tabletop games. I was disinvited from them by work friends because they thought I was messing with them when I kept asking the rules. Which, I very much understand that. If you go back to, I think, maybe 2 episodes ago, I talked about why tabletop gaming just doesn't work for me. I just don't have the patience to learn how to play them.
Nope. I love them.
And you are of a different opinion.
I will conquer the world with them.
I don't know
what that means, actually.
Said Richard, well explained on the economy of storytelling in comics. You have a massive budget, but panel space is always an issue. And then he asks, have you ever read Scott McCloud's Understanding and Making Comics?
Yeah, I use those as ref. I did a lot of my, I twisted all of my psychology / English / Spanish classes to be comic book related when I was getting my BA, and I use that as a reference very, very often. It's a great book, and I think anybody that's interested in comics or one day might, they should just check it out. It helps to understand the medium, the ins and outs of it.
Understanding and Making Comics, is that the name of the book?
The first one's just Understanding Comics. There's actually quite a few of it. There's,
oh, I it's think like a three series. Now.
There, okay. There's a newer one that just came out a couple years ago that's Making Comics. A lot of the stuff is kind of pointed towards artists, but all that information is relevant to writers too, because you should be writing towards an artist.
Right.
If you are into comics, you should check it out at some point.
Cool. He says, great show as always, Patrick and Dad by proxy. So thank you, Patrick.
Thank you
for the letter. And Dad by proxy. And remind listeners that we did an episode of their show at Make Dad Read Comics. I think we're about 2 episodes ago on their page. So if you go over there, we talk about Parker the Hunter with Dad and Patrick over at Make Dad Read Comics. Anyway, there's other stuff that we do. But this has been a long episode, so I'm not going to read the rest of this. We're on Stitcher and iTunes. Leave us a rating. Listen to Dampercast and Quarter Life Crisis. Read my reviews. They're online.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk to you next week.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.